Okay, so I'm Pierre Le Doussard from École Normale. I first want to thank the organizers, in particular Grisha, for inviting us in this great place. I'm going to talk about connections between disordered systems, well, two different fields actually, disordered systems and turbulence, and whether the methods of disordered systems can be useful for turbulence. This connection between the two fields is actually not new, but there are some aspects which are more new and probably have not been used completely. So my experience is more in disordered systems, and I came here to learn about turbulence. So please interrupt me if I say nonsense and teach me about turbulence. I want to learn. So collaborator, my main collaborator, Sky Wiese, who is here in the room from École Normale, and we've worked with Alberto Rosso from Orsay, who has done great numerical work. Andrei Fedorenko from Lyon, who is also on this Navier-Stokes project. I've worked with Jan Fedorov and with Marcus Müller. This work is supported by some French ANR grant, but actually a lot of it, part of it was actually done here in some other program, of course. And it's, of course, always a pleasure to thank the KITP for hospitality. And as you know, this is a very important sentence. Okay, so I will talk mostly about, well, maybe I should also apologize about the fact that this subject of the talk doesn't look quite fit with the general interests of the week, but this you have to talk with Grisha about it. Not responsible for that.
My responsibility.
Okay. Now that this is said, I'm going to talk mostly about Berger's turbulence. And only at the end I will mention a few things about Navier-Stokes, which is still in progress. I will start with a call-off mapping, which allows to make relation between Berger's and disordered systems. I will try to convince you that there are a class of disordered systems which are elastic objects, elastic manifold in random potential, which actually are some kind of generalization of Berger's, which are very similar physics. And although it's actually quite amazing that the two fields have actually developed separately, because there are really many, many connections. So I will mention the main method for disordered systems in the language of Berger's, and it will bring me to a recent work we did for a conjecture on decaying Berger's, which was inspired by this method. I will not have time to talk about another recent work on freezing transition decaying Berger's with Jan Fyodorov and Alberto Rosso, but it's on the archive, and so actually are all these papers if you want to have more details. And I will end up with Navier-Stokes. Okay, so let me recall a few things about decaying Berger's. And so decaying Berger's equation is basically Navier-Stokes equation without the pressure term. And it was introduced originally for dynamics in gases, but actually for turbulence, it's of most interest when the initial condition is a random function. So this is what we're going to say. The velocity at initial time is a gradient of some potential V of R. And V of R will be a random function. I will call capital D the dimension of space for the Berger's equation.
D is not one dimension, right?
No, this is a capital D dimension, okay? Any dimension, capital D.
So when you went from the convex derivative to the right-hand side, I would have thought that you would get a curl V cross omega on the right-hand side.
Yeah, but if I use this property, then this property holds. And then for all times, the velocity remains a gradient. Okay, for all times, and I'm going to denote in the remainder of the talk V hat to be the potential of the velocity for generic times, with the condition, of course, that at initial time, this V hat equals this random function. So the Kolopp transformation allows to integrate this equation very easily, and if the meaning of it is that if you want the potential for velocity at some point in space R, you have to compute this integral over an additional variable, which also is d-dimensional, and involves an energy function, which is actually the sum of the random function that you started with, initial condition, plus the random potential, initial condition, plus a quadratic part which is centered at position r and which involves time.
But V is like a string function.
Sorry?
V is like a string
function. V is a string function, yes. For me, it's a random potential because I'm used to things, yeah. But it's a string function.
No, it is potential. It's not a string function. It's potential.
Velocity potential.
Take a usual gradient of it. Not
so don't trust me for anything related to Gaussian inside.
Because would be string functions and velocity would be across.
Okay. So it's analogous to the string function, but it's not a string function. Okay. So. This integral turns out to be interpreted as, you can interpret it as the partition, the canonical partition function in statistical mechanics of a point at position u in space, which would be at equilibrium at a temperature which is equal to the viscosity. Okay? So if you have this interpretation, then you have a particle at equilibrium at a certain temperature proportional to viscosity. And if you push the analogy further, then the velocity of the Burgers equation is simply the average position of this particle in this potential, which again is the sum of a random potential plus a quadratic potential centered at point r, where you want to compute the velocity. So for instance, if the random potential is zero...
You're missing a viscosity?
Where?
The energy function.
No, the energy function does not depend on viscosity. It's an important point.
Well, maybe you're more comfortable with the dimensionality then, because they're dividing. Energy function has a dimensionality, yeah. Viscosity. Viscosity plays a role of plug constant here, like it's. Yeah. You may.
Okay.
H capital has a dimensionality.
You can also do quantum analysis, but I will not do it.
Energy divided by time. I'm just curious.
Okay, for instance, if I take a zero potential at the beginning. If V is zero, then the particle wants to be at the center of the well, so this velocity will vanish, right? So this is the correspondence between, basically between Burgers and disorder system, and now we're going to exploit it and actually generalize it. Okay, so we're going to be very interested in the inviscid limit, which is the case where the viscosity goes to zero, which correspond to zero temperature for the particle, and I will illustrate things only here in capital D equal one for the moment. So what I want to find then is the minimum of this energy function. And there is a very simple, very well-known construction, which tells us that if you start with a random function V of U, which is smooth, after a finite time, so this is a finite time potential, it will develop singularity, which are shocks. And the way it happens is that if you try to minimize this energy, what you have to do for fixed position r, you want to compute this object, for fixed position r, the green point here, you want to find the red point which has the best sum of random potential, which is this, plus elastic energy. You can think of it as some spring. Okay, so for each point here, there will be a position here. But there are some places, obviously, where there are two possible positions, okay, two possible solutions for the minimization problem, in which case you can easily see that the slope on the left here has to be equal to slope here, the slope on the right has to be equal to slope here, and there's no reason why these two slopes should be the same, so there is in general a discontinuity in slope, which means that the velocity, which is a gradient, jumps. So this is a standard construction for shocks, and you can also say that if you call u of r the position of the minimum energy for this particle in this random potential, it turns out that for large time in general, the position in this here doesn't vary much compared to jumps. So jumps will actually win at large time, and at large time, essentially this function will be just a step function with plateau and steps, and these steps will correspond if you now plot the velocity field. So this part here will correspond, the constant part corresponds to linear velocity, and then there will be jumps downwards for the velocity. Okay. So this Burgers equation is a nice example of decaying statistical turbulence. So there is some generic features that there is, of course, the details will depend on what is the initial condition exactly, what random function you choose and so on, but there are general features, which is that there's a growing scale. This growing scale is going to tell you about the scale of the shock structure, the coarsening process of the shock structure. And I'm going to call zeta this exponent. It will be later on related to exponents, roughness exponents of elastic objects in random potential. I will show you how. So there is a large scale regime, and below this typical scale, there is an inertial range regime, meaning that you can really take viscosity to zero in that region. And you do have scaling of velocity correlation. So this is equal time velocity correlation. I'm going to write it, here in a scale form. It takes a scaling form. And this function delta tilde will appear, which is a scaling function for the velocity correlation, two-point correlation, will appear repeatedly in the rest of the talk. So the other feature is that at the lower end of this inertial range, there is a viscous scale, if you have a small but finite viscosity. And this scale is related in Burgers to the width of the surviving shocks. So the shocks which have survived until time t have some width, if you have a finite viscosity, and the ratio of this width to this scale gives you an effective viscosity, which decays actually with time, quite often with some exponent theta. And it turns out that this exponent theta will also have a nice interpretation in the disordered system, as I will show you. It is actually the energy exponent for the glass systems. So to go back to Burgers, there is this dissipation of energy at the viscous scale with some finite dissipative anomaly and some energy cascade. So let me come now to system with quench disorder. So there are various types of problems that people have studied, of course. There are linear problems with random potentials, which lead to physics of localization. But the one which I think are closer to turbulence are actually the one related to glasses, where the quench disorder actually produces glass states, meaning complex energy landscape, complex ground state, many metastable states, and as we have seen on this simple shock construction, this actually will correspond to shocks. So let's say the most difficult disordered system are probably the spin glass, which are systems where there is a random sign interaction between spins, and a slightly simpler class, but still non-trivial, are disordered elastic systems, where at least interaction between particles can be described within elasticity theory, and then there is on top of it some disorder. So what we are going to actually do is to extend Burgers by adding an internal degree of freedom, which is called x. Okay, so it will become, this variable u will become a function, and this random initial condition will become random potential, random function with more variables. So this brings us to the problem of elastic manifolds in random potential. And examples are, for instance, you take a three-dimensional ferromagnet, and you look at the domain wall which separates the up spin from the down spin. So you have this surface which is parameterized by two variables. So it has some internal dimension two. And it's actually a height function which describes how this interface can move up and down and deform. So it has described by a scalar field U. Now there are other examples. For instance, there are lines where there the internal degree of freedom, I mean the, okay, so these are directed lines. So they are essentially along the x direction in three dimension, but they can actually a little bit deform around the direction. So they are described by a displacement field, which has two components and internal coordinate, which has just one component. So more generally, these objects are internal dimension, which I will call small d, and number of components, which I'll call capital D, which is the same capital D as this in Burgers' equation. So now, this is the elastic, this is the energy for this system that people usually take. study. So there is a elastic energy. This is a gradient in the internal space, x. And it wants the object to be flat, meaning u equals 0, okay, completely flat object. And then there is this random potential, which wants to deform the object because it wants to take advantage of the good spots. Now there is a competition, obviously, between the two. And as a result of this competition, there is non-trivial ground state, non-trivial minimum energy configuration, which have a nice structure of being self-affine. So they are fractal objects, self-affine with some roughness exponent zeta. They are critical objects, and that's why we...
Excuse me, what the meaning of the overbar?
Okay, yes, I have to now be very careful with that. So overbar means average over the initial condition, if you want, or this function v of u. So here it will be function v of u of x, or in general v of u. Okay? Now this average is a thermal average over this. It will disappear because I'm going to look at the inviscid limit, which is zero temperature, so you shouldn't worry too much about this one. But this is the average over initial condition. Now, why are people interested in this type of models? But because there are many physical systems which can be described by them. For instance, this is just one example of imaging of a magnetic domain wall on a film. So it's like a line in two dimensions, if you want. These are two equilibrium positions for this domain wall. And you can do statistical analysis of this configuration, and you can compute roughness exponent. And if you average over these values here, you would find an exponent in this experiment, which was done in Orsay, of about 2/3, which is actually what is predicted by the theory in this example of a line in two dimensions with short-range disorder. So that's just to show an example. Now, what does this have to do with burgers?
Yeah? Can you give an example of the ensembles of potential you use?
So this one will be a random potential, a Gaussian, a random potential with short-range correlation in both u and x. Okay, so x is this variable, this distance, and u. So there is actually, you know, there are impurities in the system. It's actually steps on the surface of the crystal, but they are very small, okay, and they are completely uncorrelated. So it gives you a Gaussian function, which will give, which will be essentially, I mean, that's a reasonable model. Okay. So what does it have to do with burgers? Okay, so to find a connection, one can actually add to this energy function another term, which will look a lot like the one we have in this Kolopf transformation. So it will be, again, a quadratic well for the manifold, centered at some position r. And the curvature, which is called m square, is actually going to be 1 over t. So t will be now the fictitious time. It will be the Burgers time. And now it looks exactly like the term in Burgers Kolopf transformation. So this is a fictitious time, okay? I mean, this manifold, this object, this domain wall, they have also their dynamics. But that has nothing to do with that. Okay, this is really about equilibrium for this domain wall and so on. And this variable is just simply some trick, but it is actually corresponding to the Burgers time.
What is R here?
Sorry? So R is, so I'm going to define a function, an energy function which will, what I want to do is to do something which looks a lot like this, okay? So I'm going to add, I'm going to define a function, I'm going to, so I'm going to define the free energy, v hat, as a function of r, which is basically the partition sum of equilibrium for this manifold in this quadratic well, okay? So this function, v hat of r, will be analogous to the potential function in the velocity field of Burgers, okay? I'm going to get more details on that. So again, what we are doing is we are generalizing the Burgers problem with adding some internal dimension. this term, actually, that we add is actually quite interesting even for manifold, for elastic object. Because, first of all, for a formal reason, first because it gives a mass. This can be seen as a mass for the propagator of the U field. So it means that there is some internal scale cutoff scale induced by this mass, and this will act as an infrared cutoff for the problem. And second, actually it happens a lot in nature that this term is there. For instance, we are going to show you later a contact line of a fluid. For this case, this term will be actually created by gravity, by capillarity. And for magnets, there's also a term like this, which comes from demagnetization forces and coming from dipolar forces. So this is a quite natural term to add, even in the problem of elastic manifold. So what about the shocks? Well, let me now define the minimum energy configuration for a given position R of the well. So for instance, if I have a line, I will have a deformed configuration U of X for a given position R of the well. So this is the center of the, this is a well, center here. And of course, the object, the elastic object, wants to be close to it, but it will be deformed. Now suppose I'm going to increase R. If I increase R, I'm moving this well. Well, in fact, essentially nothing will happen for a while because this object is spinned by this order. But at some point, there'll be another minimum in the energy landscape will take over, and suddenly the object or piece of the object will jump. So we'll find a better energy. This state will suddenly have an energy lower. Okay, so there will be some value of R where there are jumps. And the best thing to do is actually to define the center of mass position of the interface. And now this is closer to what we had in Burgers. So this is really the analogous of the velocity in Burgers, and it will exhibit shocks. So this you can do by a numerical simulation. For instance, we did one with Alan Middleton. You can actually compute the optimal position for the interface, and you can plot the shift with compared to the position of the well. So this is the analogous of the velocity in Burgers. In zero dimension, small d equals zero, it would be Burgers, but this is small d arbitrary. Here actually it's small d equal, well, I forgot what it was, but probably two or three. Yeah, probably d, small d equal two, I would think. And so you can see that the shocks, so these are different times, okay? So mass is one over, mass squared is one over t, so these are different times. So this is small time, and the time is increasing, okay? So red is small time, blue is a larger time, and green is an even larger time. And you can see that the shock is moving in that direction, which is what you expect in Burgers. In Burgers, that's also what happens. The velocity of the shock is half of the velocity here. And the shock, from which have negative velocity here, are moving this direction. And you also see that they actually merge, you know, for instance, this this blue one, there are two shocks here and here, and they will merge when time goes on into a big shock. So there are a lot of features which is very similar to Burgers, even if it's not the same, exactly the same problem. And since we have experts here, maybe some people can tell me if they are different from Burgers. I wouldn't be able to say.
So this picture. This reminds me a little bit of the difference between the quantum field theory and potential theory. It's almost like you're trying to map a quantum field theory into a Schrodinger type equation where you have the potential prescribed. And I just wonder how general you can do that.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I mean, in the one case, you don't have a potential prescribed. In one case, like from the Schrodinger equation, you would have prescribe a potential, and you would solve the problem for that. But in a quantum field theory, you know, it's like turbulence, and so you've got a fully turbulent nonlinear interactions going on. And in the other case, you've got a prescribed potential. And what you seem to be doing is to mapping the field theory into the potential theory. And how generally can you do that?
This potential here is not an external potential in which you place your quantum particle in right in Schrodinger equation. Potential here is velocity. What he gives the initial condition for velocity field, just on the language of potential. But this has nothing to do with Schrodinger potential. There is no analogy, at least not that I see again.
Yeah, you can see the analogy with Schrodinger, but it is actually initial condition which gives a. Disorder.
Yeah. So it's the initial condition where
it's all. The initial condition gives you You have to minimize the, you have to do solve the minimization problem in presence of this. And in the case of Burgers, which is zero-dimensional version of this, this is just given by the initial condition. But here also, I mean, the function v hat is equal to the function v if you take time to be zero, okay? Because then u will seem to be equal to r, essentially. Yeah.
Okay. So you've got the Hamiltonian and you've got all that sort of stuff, so it all looks...
Yeah, I write it as h, but this is really classical physics. It's classical physics. Okay, so just to show you that there are also experiments where one can actually see the things looking like shocks in Burgers. One has here contact line of a fluid which is climbing on a glass plate, and you can see these different colors here, the jumps, and you can measure the center of mass, and you...
Why it's moving? Because of surface tension?
No, because you're actually filling up the reservoir. So it's climbing. Well, actually, here on the picture is going down, but okay.
And it's just pressure-driven flow.
Yeah, just yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's very slow, okay? So it's you're doing it very slowly because you want to try to be at equilibrium. Actually, you can discuss whether you are or not at equilibrium. In this picture, you are not at equilibrium. So I'm actually cheating.
I
yeah.
How the line is going up or down as time goes? I don't follow.
Mm-hmm. Well, the experimentalists tell me that it's going down here. Yeah.
Down.
Okay. So up is here, down is here, and this is wet. And this is dry, and it's actually receding and making jumps. But it turns out this is not an equilibrium problem. So I'm cheating a little bit. This is actually called dependent transition. But it's just to show you that one principle can measure some. If one can equilibrate the system, one can measure this kind of analogous to Burgers. So let me summarize the correspondence. Analogy, I would say, is that the velocity for elastic manifold, you can define analogous object like the velocity in Burgers, and it's simply the gradient of the free energy when of your elastic manifold in presence of this well centered at position r. So that defines this, for instance, two-point correlation, and I will more generally define, so this would be an equal time two-point correlation, which I will denote by this delta of r, or actually it's r minus r prime, sorry. Okay, this is r minus r prime. This would be a capital D version. So this would be the version for Burgers in analogous to Burgers with a larger number of components, so capital D. And you see that there is a volume factor if you have an elastic manifold, but this disappears, of course, if you do D equals zero, which is decaying Burgers. Okay, so are things clear at this stage, or are there, because for the following, it's important that is it clear what the analogy is? Also, there are small d and capital D. So this is the internal dimension. And Burgers is d equals zero. But Burgers can be, of course, looked at it in any dimension rd. Okay? So this is the number of components of this field u of x. Okay? So u of x belongs to rd, capital D. Okay, so. Just to be complete, maybe confuse you even a bit more, let me mention that there is another mapping, which not exactly the same, it's related, but it's on the force Burgers system. Until now, I've talked only about decaying Burgers. So you can look at force Burgers equation. You have this additional stirring force, which is itself the gradient of some potential, which depends on time, on the Burgers time. And now, the mapping in that case goes like the following. You can now map the force Burgers not to a point, but to an elastic line, which has internal dimension 1. So the potential, which I called V hat before, call it here H, I call it here, is actually the free energy now of a line, not just of a point, but of a line, in a random potential which is given by the forcing. Okay, so this is living in a random potential given by the forcing. So this mapping, I'm not going to talk much about it, so it's just to mention it that it also exists. Then the Burgers time is actually the length of the line. So before it was the curvature of some additional quadratic well, now it's the length of this line. The forcing is a disorder, and there's similar physics, there's shocks, and there is also viscosities like temperature and so on. Okay, I'm not going to talk much more about this mapping. It's actually of quite interest recently because there are a lot of results on the KPZ growth. It's related to this, but I cannot talk about this. It's a big subject. So just to summarize, there are two different mapping, related but different mapping. There is a mapping of decaying burgers in capital D dimension onto an elastic manifold with internal dimension D equals zero, which is a complicated name for just a point, moving in capital D dimension. Then the initial condition is the random potential seen by this point. And then there is this second mapping, which is the force burgers, which maps to a line. And then the forcing is also random potential.
So what's special about the Burgers equation?
Well, it can be integrated by this Kolov mapping, by this Kolov transformation.
But how general is the process? I mean, can you...
It's not very general, fortunately. I'll come back to this. That's, of course, an important question. But I will try to explain why it can maybe still help. Okay. So just before I get to that, let me quickly tell you a few things about methods of disordered systems and well, some of my collaborators is working. Okay, great, thanks. Fantastic, okay. Okay, so, and also the limits in which we can hope to solve the problem. So it's often necessary and or convenient sometimes to use a replica method, which comes from the fact that it's very difficult to perform averages over V of some denominator like this, which occur in correlation functions. So, but there is a magic trick, which is to consider n copy of the problem, and then take the limit n to zero, the analytical continuation. In which case, this denominator is to the power n. And at n equals 0, just 1, so it disappears, there's no more denominator, and you can actually perform these other averages. Okay, so this is, in essence, the replica method. And here is the velocity, for instance, let's say in burgers, the velocity square, I mean the second moment of velocity at the same point. It will have this expression in terms of this replica. It will be an n-dimensional integral. And you can perform the disorder average, but then what happens is you couple the replica together, and you end up with a theory which is nonlinear in the replica, and it's still a difficult problem. So there are some cases where one can actually handle it, so let me just tell you. The first one is the case where the number of components of this variable u becomes large, which is infinite dimension capital D limit for burgers. And there was this very nice works on first burgers by Bouchot, Mézard, and Parisi. We are the first to do it. But they have not computed actually the distribution of shock size. So more recently, we worked on the problem for decaying burgers in the same limit and computed distribution of shock size. In some cases, we find power laws. We actually also solved the same problem for the spin glass in the same mean field limit. And turns out that the problems are very similar in this limit, but probably only in this limit, okay. So what happens, what is the simplification which occurs in this limit? Well, as always in mean field large n limit, the measure becomes Gaussian in replica, which is a bit mysterious, but what it means really is that there is some saddle point and there is a solution which breaks the permutation symmetry between replicas, as found by Parisi. And at the end of the day, the measure for this variable u here ends up being a superposition. So this point, which is living in this random potential, you can approximate this Gibbs measure, this equilibrium measure, by a superposition of Gaussian centered of random metastable states, which are themselves distributed according to Gaussian. So everything is Gaussian, but it's still non-trivial. And it gives you a nice picture of cells and of shocks, which are the walls between the cells. So I forgot to say, but when I talked to you about this shock construction in one dimension, capital D equal 1, there's of course the same construction in higher capital D, which is simply that, just to go back to this thing here. Okay, so we had this minimum energy position for this point. Now if it's a capital D space, general dimension space where this point is leaving. There will be cells where this minimum position will not vary as a function of r. And between the cells, there will be walls, which are the shocks. Codimension one manifold, which are shocks between this. Okay, I'm not going to talk more about large D, but I'm going to show you now that there is another case where one can actually solve the problem, which is around internal dimension 4. So an elastic object with internal dimension 4, but in any capital D dimension. Then the problem becomes perturbative again in a non-trivial way. I mean, you need a normalization group to be able to perform the calculation. And how does that work? Why does it become perturbative? There's suddenly a small parameter in the problem. Why? It's because when you increase the internal dimension of your interface, of your elastic object, the elasticity is becoming more important. It's more difficult to deform a sheet than a line. So the more you're going up in dimension, the more the disorder divided by elasticity, if you want, becomes small. So in fact, above four dimension, the weak disorder, or we say weak randomness in the initial condition, if you think about Burgers, then this weak random potential doesn't do anything, and you can, below four dimension, perform an expansion in powers of 4 minus d to actually compute the velocity, the analogous of the velocity correlation, order by order in 4 minus d. So that's a very nice property which happens. And how do you do that? Well, it turns out that there is an equation for the time evolution of the two-point function, the equal time two-point function of the velocity field, which I call delta of r. There is an evolution equation as a function of this Burgers time, which you can compute order by order in called a loop expansion. So this is a term of order delta squared, this is delta cube, and so on. In principle, you can get all of them. And this equation is exact equation, you know, order by order in delta. Okay, now what happens if you actually look, for instance, at these two terms here simply? So this is just coming. So it's actually convenient to write this equation not for the original correlation of velocity, but for the scaling function. So there is again this exponent zeta appearing. And this exponent zeta is going to be really the roughness exponent of the manifold. Come back to it. So if I iterate this equation, I find that the smooth function actually goes to a function which actually developed a cusp in finite time, and which is uniformly of order, so there is actually a fixed point, uniformly of order 4 minus d, uniformly of order epsilon, for small epsilon. Okay? So to get this fixed point, you can just balance these two terms. Because in fact, it turns out that the exponent, the roughness exponent, is also proportional to epsilon. And to find it, actually, one has to examine the solution of this equation. There are several solutions according to different boundary conditions on this function, how it decays at infinity and things like this. For instance, if you and for each of these boundary conditions, there is a solution with a given zeta. So for instance, if you think of Brownian initial condition for the potential of the velocity in Burgers, that corresponds to this value, which is 4 minus d over 3, 4 minus small d over 3, which is actually for small d equals 0, which is Burgers. This is actually 4 third. So this is actually exact to all orders here. Okay, and you can, in principle, compute corrections to any order.
I'm just curious, yeah. Why d equal to 4 a special case?
Well, again, come back. It's because elasticity becomes larger in 4 minus in dimension 4. Think of thermal fluctuation on an elastic object. For a line, it will roughen the line. It will be some kind of random walk. For an interface of dimension 2, internal dimension 2, it will still be straight. Okay? So there is a critical dimension, which is 2 in that case, for thermal fluctuation. For the disorder, it turns out that it's actually twice if you do the calculation. Okay, so what are the feature which one gets from the FRG, from this functional RG equation? It's called functional because it's an equation on a function, which is a velocity two-point correlation. So what you find, again, is that it's a growing length scale, which is t to the zeta over 2. So the well, this is the scale which appears, of course, in this. So if there is a fixed point for this equation, it means that there is this length scale appearing. And the value of the exponent is zeta over 2, just because, you know, so it is the roughness of the manifold. This is the roughness of the manifold. But I told you there is the mass actually produces some cutoff. So at the end of the day, you do get this t to the power zeta over 2. Okay, so there is an inertial range. So the features are very, very similar to Berger's statistical turbulence. There is an inertial range where this function acquires this cusp. So this cusp is actually telling you that there are shocks, just because the probability that you find a shock between two points is proportional to the distance between the points. It's the usual argument. So if there is some density of shocks, you end up with this behavior of the velocity correlation at small distance. And for this elastic manifold, again, there is an analogous quantity to the energy, kinetic energy in Berger's, which is exactly this function at zero. And if you look at this functional RG equation, if you take this function, if you look at this behavior, if you suppose that the function delta of r is smooth, so if you start with something like this, and delta of r, then this will be like r squared, so this will be like r4, so there will be no correction to delta of 0. And this you can show to any order. So if the function is smooth, there is energy conservation, and it's completely amazing, but in this ordered system, people have, they didn't interpret things like this, but there's this property they noticed, and it's called dimensional reduction. And they even proved it with sophisticated techniques of supersymmetry and things like this, and it's completely analogous to just energy conservation in Berger's. Now, of course, this the solution of the functional RG tells us that you are developing this cusp, which are this coming from these shocks, and then the energy conservation is violated, and there is energy decay, and you can compute actually order by order in epsilon the coefficient for this decay. Order by order in 4 minus d, and you can also match at the bottom of the inertial range. There is also a viscous scale if you want, which you can perform functional RG at finite temperature, and then you can show that these two terms are equal, meaning that there are high velocity gradients at small scale if you have finite viscosity, and you can match the two regime one onto each other. And you end up with the fact that there is also a dissipative anomaly for any of these systems, okay? So it's very, very similar to. So what else can you compute with this functional normalization group? You can compute the distribution of shock size. You can define the size of a shock to be the jump in velocity across the shock. And again, I remind you that the analogous of velocity for a manifold is the position simply of the center of mass. So it's jumping, and you're asking the size of these jumps. And you can compute around four dimensions the higher moments. You can show that they have this multiscaling characteristic of Berger's, I mean, the same as in Berger's. And you can extract from this scaling the moments of the avalanche size, shock size distribution. In four dimensions, you find this result, and you can compute it in expansion around four dimensions. You find that there are corrections to the exponent, the shock exponent 3/2. And there is actually a general conjecture by Narayan and Fisher for the value for this exponent in any small d, which actually works quite well with small d equals 0. So it goes down to d equals 0 quite nicely. And to order epsilon, we actually proved that it was correct. So it's probably, I mean, it may be actually an exact result. So this shock size distribution has a Paolo behavior for the size of the shock. But then it has some cutoff at large for the large shocks, and with some stretch exponential exponent, one can actually compute. And there's also another factor, which is some kind of bump, gives some kind of bump in the curves, which have been has been seen in numerics. So this explains very nicely, actually, the numerics. OK, so up to now, this is very nice. I showed you an extension of Burgers to higher internal dimension, where you can actually make a controlled calculation. But it's a calculation around four dimensions, so how do you get down to zero dimension? Question, can you make some prediction directly in zero dimension? And in some cases, it turns out that the answer is yes. And I'll give you an example, which I will call a conjecture. We challenge some people to prove or to disprove it. Actually, proving it will be interesting, disproving it will be equally interesting. So here is the example. So you're going to give yourself, so now I'm talking really about decaying burgers. You're going to give yourself a velocity, initial condition for the velocity field, which is Gaussian, which has independent increments along any line. So along any line in this capital D dimensional space, which is arbitrary, it is like a Brownian initial velocity along any line. But of course, it's very correlated still, because you know all these lines are correlated between each other. So this is the initial it's a generalization, if you want, of this Brownian initial velocity in capital D equal 1 to higher D. So what's special about this? Is there anything special? So let's look at the functional RG equation. Here is the functional RG equation. So let me now, if you want, generalize the problem to a manifold, same initial condition. And look at functional RG equation. Well, it turns out I'm going to write it for the derivative of the velocity correlation, because the derivative initial condition for this derivative is just that it's a constant, OK? If I take this, take a derivative, I just get a constant. I write it here without the indices. I write it in one dimension for simplicity, but you can do exactly this in, with all the indices in high dimension. You want to burden the transparency. So you can see immediately on this that If I choose initial condition which is constant, this term will actually hold zero. And you can check that higher order are also zero. So we have now, but okay, we don't know how to prove it to any order, but we have now a conjecture. Okay, so you can see that if I choose for zeta the value epsilon, which means a length scale going like t square, then there is exact, at least one loop. This is zero, and you can check two loops. So we have conjecture by examination by some filteritic argument that this is true to any order in any dimension.
It's not a conservation rule.
No. Ah, okay. I don't know. I mean, maybe of what?
I would hear you got say that it was four.
Maybe it's a conservation of something. Yes. Sorry.
Here you got 4 minus d/3.
But that was for random potential, which would be Brownian. If you take the potential, it would be Brownian. The velocity is the gradient of the potential. If the potential is Brownian, you get this.
All right.
Okay? So but here, it's the velocity which is Brownian. It's something which people...
Your perturbation parameter now is 4.
Yeah, so again, I have an expansion parameter around... Yeah, epsilon is 4.
It's 4.
But so if I can prove to all orders that it's true, and that there are no non-perturbative corrections, and so on and so on, then, of course, okay. So that's why I call it a conjecture. Okay, examination of all the corrections, so they all vanish. So maybe there is some conservation law, there is some symmetry, something which we don't understand. But it's tempting to make this conjecture. So let's make this conjecture and see the consequence for this and make some numerical checks. So this is, for instance, in two dimensions. These are the cells which I was telling you about with the shock walls between the cells. This picture was made by Kai, who has a very nice taste for colors. And you can find here, this, these are actually this U position for minimal energy position corresponding to each of these cells. So what I'm going to do now is to consider a line crossing an arbitrary axis, x, let me call it, crossing this picture. It will encounter shocks, and I'm going to look at the statistics of the shocks that it's encountering. But these shocks now, you are in higher dimension, Burgers, so you have actually a jump which is actually proportional to this difference between these two values of minimal position. So it can have a component along the direction of the axis or orthogonal to the direction of the axis. And this is the coarsening process. Okay, you see this domain has disappeared if you increase time and so on. But I'm just going to look at a fixed time and ask what is the statistics of the shocks. More precisely, I will the consequence. So if you admit that this first derivative is actually constant to all orders for any time, that's what it means, then you can actually do a calculation of this object, which is the generating the characteristic function of the velocity difference along a given line. And you can show that it's equal to this within this assumption. So it's simply proportional to x. Okay, lambda x is just a parameter which enters here. It's the first component of lambda. So there is no x dependence apart from here, meaning that it's really telling you that the shocks along a line are completely uncorrelated. And their distribution has a Laplace transform which is given by this. So we have two predictions. The shocks are uncorrelated, and we can compute the Laplace transform of the distribution. What we find is that the x component of the shock has the same distribution as in one dimension. And I want to say that the conjecture is actually proved, I mean, was actually proved before it was made by Bertoin. So in one dimension, we know already that Burgers with Brown initial condition has this property. But the question is whether in higher dimension one can find, you know, this is also holding for this model. And our conjecture is that it is actually also working with the same distribution of the x component of the shocks. And the distribution over y is more complicated. One has to, the Laplace transform is given by some elimination of some variable between this equation. You can compute it numerically, the Laplace transform, and compare with numerics. So now we've done numerics with Alberto Rosso, and this is a comparison of the prediction. This is a shock distribution along x, shock distribution along perpendicular to x in two dimensions. And most strikingly, I think, is the measure of the correlation of the sizes of successive shocks along the line. And we find these are the squares here, that there's strictly zero correlation. And we compare with other models, for instance, this one, when you have a random potential which is Brownian, and there you can see the correlations. These are the circles. And these are the correlation between distance between shocks and their size. And again, there is strictly no correlation between distance between successive shocks and the size of the shocks for numerically it seems. So numerically it looks reasonable. Okay, so now it's a challenge for mathematicians.
Are those just the results?
Sorry?
Are those the results?
Those are results from numerical simulation.
But in the case of in the limit of zero.
Yeah, it's implicit limit, yes. So we're just minimizing the potential. We were using Kolob's transformation to do the numerics. It's just a minimum position.
In that case, the numerics was done in just a straight way, time integration, space time integration.
No, we are not simulating. We're just minimizing. We're using Kolob. We are minimizing for fixed time t, minimizing the potential, the Kolob potential.
Okay.
So I think that's why it's quite accurate. I mean, it's very accurate. So in the 5 minutes left, I can talk about Navier-Stokes. Okay, so Navier-Stokes equation written in Fourier space. And if you take different forms for the projectors, you can either have Burgers, so you can have incompressible Navier-Stokes. Now, of course, for Navier-Stokes, we don't have Kolob. So what is the question? The question is there, what would be the analogous thing to do that we did for Burgers using this functional normalization group? What would we do just to if we just apply it to Navier-Stokes? Okay. And it turns out that the answer is the following. You can define the velocity correlation again, k space, and you can write the exact hierarchy of correlation functions. So 2-point correlation, 3-point correlation, 4-point correlation of velocity. There's an exact hierarchy, exact equation for hierarchy of this correlation function. And what, at the end of the day, what the functional energy method does exactly is to look for a solution. You can rephrase it by saying it's look for a solution of this hierarchy which has this behavior at small, this small time behavior. So and it's a loop expansion. It's actually not a direct small time expansion. It's a renormalized small time expansion in the sense that the equation for the two-point correlation is actually a closed equation. Okay, I mean it has higher order terms, but involves only delta. So, of course, since there are experts here, they will immediately see that this is very close to a closure approach. And in fact, if you write down the equation to one loop, so here I gave you what you need to do to two loop in a highly symbolic form, but we have actually right now done it only to, I mean, okay, we started calculation to two loop, but we have this is the result for one loop, and you can certainly see that this equation, which is directly in the implicit limit, so this is, again, I'm repeating, it's exactly the analogous equation as the functional algebra equation for manifold, but done for Navier-Stokes, and it looks, okay, so what does it make you think of? What equation is that? Well, you...
What is the n, large n? What is the...
Yeah, n, sorry, there's a change on the chart. N is d, actually. So I call n here the dimension of space, I'm sorry. So n is actually capital D. Okay, so this equation is actually quite similar than the... so how do you call this one? Normal, quasi-normal, right? Quasi-normal approximation. But maybe it is, okay, so it has all the good properties of the quasi-normal approximation, which are energy conservation, entropy conservation, and cascades, and so on. But we are looking at it from a slightly different perspective, because we just look at it as a one-loop equation, and you can ask the question, what would it become at higher loops? So let me first look at the one-loop result. So if you analyze this equation in three dimension, and you ask, so the important question is whether there is a cusp or no cusp, or what is the behavior of the velocity field. Now, if you plug in this equation, this solution, with some value, zeta 2, you plug it in the right-hand side, and you ask what is coming out, and you want it to be the same as what you put in, you're looking self-consistently for a solution. So that will bring you to a condition that some amplitude is vanishing. And for Navier-Stokes, this condition looks like this for one loop, for this equation I showed you. And by the way, you can do it for Burgers. For Burgers, you immediately get zeta 2 equal 2. There's an analogous formula. So you can look at all the roots of this equation. So there are many roots, actually, but there are only reasonable ones. And the reasonable ones, unfortunately, in three dimension, have zeta 2 equal 1, so which is still far from the expected value for Navier-Stokes. And so there are two questions at this stage. First is, why do you get 1? Okay, so if somebody knows the answer to this, why does this...
For Burgers, it will be also 1.
Yeah, sure. For Burgers, 1. But okay, so but why would you get 1 here? I mean, it's relatively different equation. So that's remark number one. So I'd like to understand more precisely why you get this. And second thing, if you now look at two loop, okay, we started the calculation, we haven't finished it, it's really, really extremely heavy. You have some hope that there will be additional term in this equation. So maybe there is some hope that the value of zeta 2 then will be different for.
All depends on n. If n goes to infinity, whatever.
Okay, so the statement is that this equation has always a root equal to 1 for any n. Except, sorry, for any n bigger than 2 point something. Well, there are all kinds of strange things happening here, n equal to. I mean, there's roots all over the place.
Irrespective of the dimension n, so zeta 2 is always.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, no. No, no, because look, in two dimension, there is solution without...
No, two dimension is special.
Okay, two dimension is special. So for n bigger than 2 point something, there is, no, there is always a solution, but there are other ones with higher value of zeta 2.
Isn't the problem is that almost any solution you can come up with reduces to one for which the vertex renormalization is essentially dropped. And once you have vertex renormalization, you're stuffed. So you have two types of solutions. You have the trivial one corresponding to the DIA or something like that, or you have a non-trivial one which you can't solve, which involves significant vertex renormalization. So you either have a limit where the coupling constant is very small, like quantum electrodynamics or something like that, where you can do something perturbatively, or you have strong turbulence and you're stuffed.
Yeah, well, okay. We should discuss it more detail, but okay, so this is a situation in three dimension, and now in two dimension there is actually some, okay, we did some very naive numerical estimate, but we found that there is some fixed point which has actually, well, there is the right cascade and so on, there is energy conservation, which by the way means that the exponent zeta is given by what people in this old system call dimensional reduction value. So in fact Batchelor and Larkin did the same thing without knowing it, but so the fixed point looks something like this, and presume, okay, according to Grisha it has to have some logarithmic corrections, which people have discussed in the literature, but so this we haven't seen, but maybe they will explain this slight discrepancy we have here. So there is actually a fixed point in two dimensions. Now in higher dimension you can look at this equation and find it actually becomes quite similar to Burgers in some sense, which I'm not going to discuss here. So let me just conclude, because I feel that the chairman becoming nervous. So we have a generalized Burgers to manifold of arbitrary internal dimension, and Schön has very similar physics with energy cascade and inertial Lorentz shocks. Around four dimension there is, you can call it loop expansion, you can call it functional normalization group, you can call it truncation. But what's important is that they become controlled perturbatively. So then you can compute energy decay, shock size distribution is limit. This led us to a conjecture for solution of Burgers equation in more than one dimension with some generalization of Brownian initial condition. Now if you naively try the same approach brutally, I would say on Navier-Stokes, you get in three dimension this value 1, and there is maybe still some hope that if you look at higher loop corrections or if you look at some right thing, you can change this value and get something more reasonable. And well, I mean, the general observation is I think it is still interesting to learn about situation where the closures and truncations become actually controlled. Okay, so that gives one experience at least about this. Okay.
I mean, the DIA is sort of unique in that you can, do something reasonable. If you take an arbitrary number of loops and arbitrary number of diagrams, you can get anything you like. And there's no guarantee taking any sort of arbitrary number of diagrams for strong interaction will give you anything other than nonsense. So, you know, it's really...
Well, that's a pessimistic view of things, but...
Sorry?
That's a pessimistic view of things, but I agree that
that is the case. I mean, Craigland showed that in his 64 paper that if you take...
Yeah, it works for Burgers, okay? It works very nicely for Burgers.
Yes, yeah. But if you take any arbitrary number of loops or a number of diagrams, you won't get convergence. You won't get the Kolmogorov laws.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a small parameter, so in that sense, you're absolutely right. But it would be still very nice to see that, you know, what are the diagrams, what are the higher loop terms, which will give you a deviation from this, okay? And also to understand why you get this. I mean, again, I'm coming to this thing naively, and...
I'd like to add some optimism to this, because I especially want to say that Koto has some... very convincing numerical argument, and I published some very unconvincing analytical argument that the mainstream dimensionality Navier-Stokes must have scaling as Burgers equation. Not exact scalar function, because it's even compressible case, but the scaling of the Burgers equation, in particular zeta 2, it's an exact result.
Yeah.
Which means that this approach may be really meaningful if you consider the infinite dimension.
Yeah.
Then it gives you that is asymptotic, maybe not in this direct form, maybe some kind of normalized form. And then your two-loop expansion would give you one of the n correction, which would then be meaningful to compare with Navier-Stokes, because Again, there is no Kolmogorov scale in this, just total nonsense. I mean, zeta 2 is not equal to 2 thirds. It's something which depends on dimensionality. It's not far from 2 thirds in 3D. In 4D, it's probably different. In infinite dimensionality, it's unity. And the whole cure was something which would be interesting to get as one of the end direction. So in this respect, I believe this is kind of interesting, but not, you don't start in 3D, you start from infinite D.
You know, I agree that if you put together the knowledge of what happens in large N or large capital D, and what happens around this 4 epsilon magnetization, you can probably get something, but it's hard work. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I tried it.
Yes, yeah, just one comment, adding to the uses. So the if you apply the quasi normal to the approximation to the pressure, so you can simply show that the pressure terms becomes very small in that last unit of D. So if you neglect the pressure terms, of course, you have the Douglas equation in the estimate of T. That's the one question. And the second is, my questions are, can you apply your method to compute some PDF or velocity gradient or something?
Yeah, that's what we'd like to try.
No, that it's not quasi-normal. That's the whole point of it. You go to infinite dimensionality, you go towards the Dirichlet's limit, and Dirichlet's is very non-Gaussian. The statistics of any component is non-Gaussian, only scalars give it Gaussian, but you cannot have equations for scalars. So, I mean, the whole non-trivial point of this exercise is that we probably know what is asymptotic large dimensionality in terms of scaling, but it's not Gaussian asymptotic. In any way, it's quasi-normal. Some things are quasi-normal, of course, which are scalars.
Some statistics works for the source term, the pressure, Poisson equation of pressure. It is summed on the d square terms. That's a plenty of reason that we have the some close to Gaussianity. Also, it's not exactly Gaussian, but still may have some chance to the statistics close to Gaussian. Then, in that sense, so why don't you try to, from starting to the large limit of D?
Yeah, but then again, we know that there are some Gaussian quantities at large D. I mean, any scalar is Gaussian at large D because it's a sum of D components. But we can also write, we can write the equation for this quantity. Our equation is for a vector field. And this vector field, every component, if it is getting, as you've shown, is getting more than Gaussian if you go to one of large D.
There's some knowledge about this. I mean, we know it's a superposition of Gaussian given by this hierarchical.
But on the other hand, doing this in other large D, we do know what happens to it. Okay, I mean, still, there is something meaningful here. No more questions? Okay. Have a good weekend. And,